Too many choices plague my mind. Do I guess or do I troll this time? Woo!
All right, folks, welcome to the Muskie 360 podcast, a Jay Bird.
Hey there, Steve.
I am sitting here actually in Jay's driveway, broadcasting live from the Muskie Shop Jeep studios here, still road tripping, still trucking.
Overlooking the giant Muskie on the garage.
Overlooking Muskie Garage here in the illustrious Northwoods of Wisconsin. Almost done with the big summer run here. Haven't been home since June kind of deal. But nonetheless, it has been quite the interesting thing. But I pull in. Jay and I are kicking it today and pull in, and it's just fall, Jay.
Yeah.
It is just
fall, meaning a different season.
Yeah. Trust me, Canada was definitely on a whole different tip the last 2 weeks, right? Okay. And water temperatures. I mean, it's just, this is not the dog days of summer. Usually in August, you get those, you know, 2 week period, 3 week period of just brutal heat up north, you know. Yeah. You'll get those real, just skipping her this year, Jay.
Haven't had much of it this August for sure.
Yeah, it's so kind of unusual, not unusually, but kind of cooler than expected, and it's throwing a lot of people for a loop right now. I'm hearing it endlessly, you know, getting the emails, getting the texts and the phone calls, and talking to my guide buddies. It's a different world out there. You know, you can't fish the calendar right now would be the number one thing I got to tell you. Is whatever the date says, or you're, you know, if you're using the fishing journal on the app, or you're looking back at your notes, make sure you're looking at water temps. You know, pay attention to the temperature on the water, not so much, oh, it's the last week of August, because it is just entirely a different game right now, the way fish are staging. I'm seeing fall staging so much already, right? I'm out in the water, we're out there pounding around, and you'll see the staging is just more fall-esque. I don't know, Jay, if you've checked, we haven't gotten the read on the water here on the weed situation in the North Woods, but there were already dying weeds in Canada all over the place. You know,
I saw a little bit of that in the fishing I did in the last 7 days. Yes,
right.
I see the same thing.
Yeah. And you're sitting here going, it's a smidge early.
Mm-hmm. It's a smidge just, early. That's what it is.
It's three weeks. Yeah, it's a few weeks ahead. And you just go, you know, you look at your notes here, if you're fishing memories, and you go, oh, 2 weeks ago it was, or last year it was topwaters and bucktails. Well, it is not topwaters and bucktails, my friends.
Time for the Adjustment Bureau.
Yeah, if you're a day late and a dollar short on this one, you're just going to be completely left out in the lurch, because it's just a different world. We just skipped. We had like 8 week of August, and then it went boom, fall. You know, and I was just seeing the first trees change in Canada when I was like, going, oh my goodness, you got to be kidding me. You know, some of the trees were already starting to go, and then, I mean, I'm sitting here and 56 degrees here in the middle of the day, right? Been cold, windy, and rainy out, and just getting slapped around by that stuff all day long. And you hit this, and you go, it's 56. That's about where the high is. It'll probably creep up to 60 tomorrow. And so make those adjustments. I mean, it is, in my opinion right now, it is time to frickin' strap on the dive and rise and start working your Krakens and start working rubber. Those fish are just going to be moving out, and just already there. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's not really, it's more of a hypothetical or a theoretical. If the fall hits this early, how long is that window going to last before they just pull off and they suspendo and do the winter stuff, Jay? You know? It's always an interesting thing to see, hey, is this going to just expedite the entire process right now, you know, or is it just going to be an extended fall? Yep. Are you there?
Yeah.
Loser. Sorry.
Yep. I'm here.
There you go. Sorry, the phone.
Beeping.
Yeah, it's the beeping thing. It's the freaking.
No, I hear what you're saying, Steve. I mean, you know, if we were able to get out today, I think it would have been the more pauses, the better in whatever the presentation.
You know? We're too busy filming videos to actually, it's, you know, Jay and I are out here doing the Lord's work for you. Can't even catch them when we're doing it. But no, that's what you're saying. Extended pause, extended hanging, you know, just with that water temps. I mean, I was seeing 60s pretty consistently already. And I mean, I know it's dropping here, so you're just going to have to get ahead on those patterns. And goodness, Jay, I mean, when do the suckers start going here at the shop?
Well, I think they will. I think they will very shortly here. You know, the extended forecast is below normal. Let's put it that way. You know, I saw some 70s in the long range for Labor Day's next weekend already, which is remarkable to think of in its own. But yeah, you know, like low 70s or something. I guess it's not far off from normal. But, you know, we got those cool nights now. You know, it's bringing the water temps down. Weeds are going to start dying. Yeah, I think we're looking at a little bit early of a fall adjustment in terms of, you know, change of seasons here. So, and change of tactics. So
change, like you said,
with suckers. Yeah, we're going to have to start stocking up because
it's going to happen early. I mean,
yeah, it's going to happen early. Yeah, usually by this year. Yeah, by September 1st for Labor Day, guaranteed. Yeah. It's going to be effective, and it will be easier to keep them alive and fresh when the water's cooler, the air temp's cooler. You're not dealing with direct sunlight on any kind of transpo on them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
They're as fragile as muskies. They really are. You know, they're very, very much they will be affected by big changes in temps. It just shocks
them. Keeping suckers alive as hell. It's they're,
it can be. They're cooler finicky, the better. You know, the cooler the better. That's just how they, guys, how they thrive. Yeah.
Yeah, it's gonna be interesting though. Like I said, well, I could be completely wrong, and all the temps switch, and it's 85 next week. But you know, it just seems like the weather cycle just decided to do a little giddy up and go ha ha. You know, and another reason too, especially if you're planning. You know, there's a lot of guys, Jay, that do the big fall trip. There's a tournament. You know, you have the big tournament in Saint Germain coming up. You've got a lot of fall musky trips planned.
Absolutely.
And that's, I think the advice I would give again is make sure you got your stuff, because a lot of guys kind of load the boat and load their tackle boxes based on history. And that's a dangerous thing to do. I mean, it's like here, I've been gallivanting across North America now for 2 months, and my truck is just packed with crap and my boat is packed with crap. I mean, I got more baits then you can shake a stick at, but it's not because I want to have a bunch of baits. It's because you just don't want to get caught with flat footed. You know, if it turns into a rubber bite and things like this happen, and it just goes along the lines of just being prepared. You know, I've always thought too, even if you're going like a dedicated run and you're like, okay, we're fishing lakes X, Y, and Z, and it's always been, you know, this is our first week in September, and it's topwaters and bucktails, and you got limited tackle. I would still make sure you brought a Plano flat or some other options. Just don't fish what you expect to fish, I think, right now. Hopefully it'll turn.
Agree.
You know, have that option of some rubber and some swim baits. I mean, what was interesting this year is that swim bait bite was so hot at the beginning of the year when the waters was in the 60s, right? Then it got warm, and you started seeing 70s, and they come off the swim baits, and you get a little bit burnier, and you get a little bit more bladey, right? And that's where I'm going to freaking hang my hat right now, as I think the swim bait bite's just going to come back right like it was. You know, it seems to me, because of pressure and because of conditioning, you know, swim baits are more reliable. In my boat, they're more reliable than blades as far as producing strikes for mature fish. You know, because if you notice and you're out there and you're doing it, you go, okay, if you have that tandem going, so you know you're in a straight retrieve thing, even in the fall conditions, you got a guy on, say, you know, 8-9 stagger or whatever he's throwing, and you put somebody on swim bait, and you're going to notice not a quantity thing, but a quality thing. And I think it just, just goes because the muskie angling pressure, that's a whole other thing we can talk about, but the conditioning and the pressure that these fish are under is at the highest I think it's ever been. You know, you've got more muskie anglers than ever. You've got more intelligent muskie anglers than ever. You've got information. You've got podcasts, videos, everything. You got the app. I mean, you know, we contribute to that problem of bringing new people to the fold and helping them be more successful. But with that, you've got to make, that's another adjustment you got to make. And it, that's just from a pressure standpoint. I saw up in Canada where you go, oh, you know, we're on, you know, Eagle Lake. And you think, you know, it's the vast wilderness. It's not. There's freaking 30 boats in every bay. You know, everybody's hitting that stuff. And I think that's just another thing to consider if you're the guy that does the 1 week trip, or you're the guy that, you know, you got your weekend or whatever, you probably need to just break from convention off the rip. You know, because it's hard to do, but whatever you think your frontline plan of attack is, you probably ought to not do it. If it involves blades and top water, put her away. You know, and it's from pressure. I mean, I'm not one to bitch and moan about pressure. You gotta deal with it. You gotta fish around it and with it and morph your game. But what I'm hearing, and I'm just getting, you know, between the text, calls, emails, all that fun stuff, and talking to buddies, the guys that are not doing something different right now and they're not changing are getting trounced handedly, right? Where
okay.
It's one of those deals where, you know, you felt like, you know, you could confidently put some fish in the boat, and you go and you do your week and you get one, right? Why am I on, you know, and there's numbers lakes in Canada. There are, right? And some of these bodies of water that are, you know, they're not known for 50s, but you got scuds of 44, 45s, 46s blazing around and more 30s than you can shake a stick at, right? Well, those are getting beat up harder than ever as well. And there's a lot of value in just breaking from the convention of what everybody else is doing, even when you're going up to Canada, or especially coming to the North Woods, where the fish have seen it all, right? They've seen it. Mm-hmm. Your Bukertel 700 will put one in the boat, but is it going to put one in the boat 7 days a week after all the summer pressure? Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I think that's the thought, especially going into fall, which we, you know, we're saying it's happened sooner. I think the transition needs to be made now because the pressure was high this year. There's a lot of boats. Jay, you said last week was one of the busiest weeks at the store, just people being in town. Right. And
pretty intense.
Yeah. Just people pounding, packing it in up here. And so at a certain point you go, have the muskies at this juncture, have they not seen a bait? I bet you they have. Bet you they have.
I'm just thinking about your reflections on Canada, because we finally got last night, you know, we got a chance to catch up and, you know, catch up. We haven't hardly talked.
No,
you know,
God,
in the last,
no.
In the last like week, crazy. You know, do a yeah. So you went up there. You were fishing on Eagle Lake for the most part. Eagle Lake.
Yeah, Eagle Game.
For the better part of a month.
Yeah.
Right, but you know, you're home based on Eagle, so you spend a lot of time there. So, you know, you got an advantage over a lot of people that, you know, you got almost 4 weeks. You know, a lot of people they'll have a 5 or 6 day trip and they're destined to deal with the conditions. And that's something we all have. You know, we only have X amount of time to fish and you make the most of it, you know. And like you said, number one, you know, okay, it's this time of the year, you know, you're prepared because you've heard online or from friends. It's just like, okay, this time of the year or from previous years, this is what's working. You got firsthand and you're telling everybody this, which is the cool part too, that it's constantly changing. You had bite A, bite B, bite C, bite D. It was hot. It was cold. Okay, mm-hmm. today, tomorrow, and the next day, we're going to have to make some adjustments because there's a massive weather change.
Mm-hmm.
Water temps dropped a bit, and that's early. It's 2-3 weeks early. They shouldn't have dropped that much right now. that changes the whole complexity of how you got to look at things. And so, you know, like I said, and what you told me, you know, the bike can be hot, it can be very cold, and there's everything in between. So I just,
yeah,
okay, you know what I mean? Like the first part of the trip too, it was like majors, but it was all moon based.
Yeah.
And then there was a stretch where it completely unraveled.
Yep.
That wasn't as important. Yeah. So there's a lot of information there, and it's just like,
there's one
attention to that. There's some cool things to learn.
Go ahead. One thing, and I called Dr. Bob yesterday when I was driving back, and you know, looking at this deal, and it's typical, I actually stay a hair longer, but I have to go, got to go overseas here in about an hour and a half is what it feels like. But we ran into a bug hatch that if to say it was tough is an understatement.
Right. You didn't tell me this, but right. Yeah.
So what had happened, and it's funny, it's so funny where we talk about being observant and, you know, kind of keeping notes and logging things. And that bug hatch happened. I was unaware of what kind of bug it was. I've never seen it. And it looked like smoke over top of the islands, right? These spires of bugs. And I've got video and photos of it. It's kind of spooky looking. And it sounded like, you know, 400 helicopters taking off in the evenings, because, and they weren't mosquitoes. These were like a midge aphid looking weird, kind of like a mayfly little deal without a tail, right?
Huh.
Long story short, immediately, and let me preface that with, we were hitting one spot and it was a very calm day. And I looked at the water and I said, what are these? What is this? And I stuck my hand in the water and I pulled up a bunch of exoskeletons, right? And it was just these tiny, clear exoskeletons where these fish had, or these bugs had shed that exoskeleton and went from subaquatic to freaking airborne terrestrial bugs, right? And I noticed that on the first day. And then after that, it got so freaking hard, you wanted to shoot yourself, right? So going out and learn and trying to figure this out, I'm speaking to everybody I know and everybody's getting their butts kicked, but nobody knows anything about this bug hatch. Not a soul. And I found that to be so unusual. I'd never experienced it. And really nobody else had seen it at that volume or could. There was no even anecdotal story, Jay, for somebody to say X, Y, and Z is happening, or we saw this happening in this year, or we saw it happen 7 years ago, or whatever it might be. So, going to be a lot of reflection and research on that to figure out what's going on, which was just bizarro to see a bug hatch of that magnitude take place, much less that really nobody had any history or nobody really had any discernible direction of oh, it takes place, you know, we're a month early on this, or it takes place X, Y, and Z. Nobody really knew.
Right, because it doesn't take place. It was an unusual event.
And it's just like, and especially that volume. So that was a weird one. And like I said, I believe it or not, got a client that's an entomologist, so I'm going to get with him and shot him an email already to try to figure out, hey, what did these things just move into the area, or you know, or what kind of cycle are they on? Because the only thing I could get was, it wasn't like one of these annual bug hatches. This is like some condition happens subsurface that causes all these, and it's not the right term, but it's not dissimilar from like looking like a tiny helger mite, right?
Mm-hmm.
These things that are living on the bottom for years, you know, and they just decide, we're gonna hatch this year. what makes that happen? You know, that's kind of crazy. But no, I mean, from a learning standpoint, that was a neat experience and kind of just skull drudgery fishing through it. You know, that when you have the entire food chain move, it was funny. Had crappies out at 25 feet in August on the bottom. That, you
gorging.
Know,
yeah.
Just yeah. All gorging. Sure. And so, you know, the whole thing moved, but now it's interesting. And one other observation, just in general, I would say is, I basically every year have to get reminded of it, because I do fish the entire habitat range throughout the course of the year, it always kind of boggles my mind of just how intolerant of change Canadian muskies are, right? And it's like a sliding scale on the edges of habitat range. But it's just so funny. They're just one tick more intolerant or annoying as far as small changes. You know, if it has any value to any degree as well. The other thing that I freaking, you know, just the impact of wind. You know, we had such shifty winds. And dealing with just the impact of neighbor Steve's pulling in, folks. Neighbor Steve alert. But anyway, just the impact of wind changes, which is so funny. And again, I think it's far more impactful in Canada on the Shield Lakes. That it was almost like, oh, here's the wind shift, and then they started moving again, which was so funny. Right? And I've noticed it in the past. And I try not to get hyper-fixated on it, but this year it was so glaringly obvious. Like, okay, we got an east wind, it sucks, right? East wind's horrible. East wind stops for 10 minutes, flattens out, and boom, there comes one. And there, it's very funny how a lot of the old tropes, you know, they call it the east wind blues and, you know, all these things, and it's just so funny how quickly those fish shut off and then turn back on when there's climactic change, you know? And again, you brought it up. The only other observation I would have is I'm agnostic about the moon sometimes. I stole that from Dr. Bob, but, you know, even in Next Level Musky Fishing in the book, I talk about, you know, how I pay no attention to it, and the chapter split in two, like complete different thoughts. For the first half of it this year, that was just, you had to live and die by it. It was, you know, there was nothing. It wasn't that I was fishing harder inside or out of it, right? And I wasn't holding my best areas to hit. So I was trying to not influence that by going, okay, I'm going to fish really crappy areas, and I'm only going to hit my good stuff during the majors. You see what I'm saying?
Absolutely.
That's not the case. I'm always, when I'm up there, I'm slinging for bigs and pigs. That's it. You can, if I'm sorry, I'll take a 40 inch or grab it by the ears and chuck it off the side of the boat. Don't care. Right. And so to stay on bigs and pigs, you need to be hitting bigs and pigs areas that are proven producers. And it was just like clockwork. There they come. There they come. You know, the other one, if I can ramble a smidge more, Jay, the impact on scope up there. Remember this year on the podcast, you know, we had Cal Ritchie and Steve Herbeck coming up and talking about it. And,
right,
you know, I heard a lot about scope when I was in Canada this year. A lot of scope talk, a lot of people have a lot of feelings about it.
They right? do.
And I'm sure this winter it'll be the same thing. This is what always happens. Dr. Bob nailed it when he said, I asked him in a private conversation, I said, what do you think's going to happen with scope this season? After everybody's kind of prattling on about it, and he and I did kind of that response episode about it and all that. And he nailed it. He hit it dead center. Where he said, everybody will forget about it once they start fishing again, and they'll just bitch again this winter. Right? Which is the case, but it's funny seeing it and running into, you know, you're talking, this is big, this pretty big leaguey up there, Jay. You're running into a lot of good people, right?
Sure.
The impact of production that scope is having for people versus people that are not running scope up there is ridiculous. Not even the same sport. Not the same numbers, not the same amount of contacts, by any means. Like, the gap is so wide right now, and, you know, I use scope in the way that I use it, which is, you know, I have it set up for figure eights, and I've got it I've got a perspective mode pointing backwards, kind of see things that slip by the boat. I just don't target enough areas at home where I want to sit there and specifically sharpshoot a fish or make a cast at a mark that I know it's a muskie's adjacent from the boat, right? I'm very proficient at it, but I just go, it's not my cup of tea anymore. Well, what I'm seeing and what I've experienced up there and been around on a bunch of different people's boats is the amount, and I get why some of these people were, some of the arguments about the pressure, right? The guys that are really freaking good at it are staying on so many fish all day long that are really not catching a break. Right?
What that are not catching a break. What do you mean by
the
that?
The fish are not catching a break.
Gotcha. Right? Okay.
Where, say, physically, you would only move, say the muskies would only move during a major, right?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, I've always said they ain't in the woods, right? They're not in the woods. They've got to be in the lake. Well, where do they go and what do? Well, so they're not moving, but you go, oh, well, there's rocks and there's an extra lump on those rocks. Guess what that is?
Right.
And I've shown this to people before on my boat with Scope. We go, look there's a bump. That's not supposed to be there. That's a muskie. You put a bait down there and he moves. When you're that dialed in. And I think what's funny, I was literally riding around in the boat and having a deep thought where, yeah, I thought about, I don't know how to put it. I've not rectified it enough in my head to write something about it yet, but I will. But the thought was that, you know, it used to be about the hunt. It used to be about finding muskies, right? And I really think that if we continue on the trajectory that we're on, that it's no longer going to be about finding muskies. This is going to be about triggering strikes, and that's all that's going to matter. What do you have to do to trigger a strike is the utmost important thing, because finding them is neophyte now. If you know where to look, and more people are going to learn where to look, if you know what I'm saying, right?
But by saying that, on a positive aspect of that is people will learn how to properly present baits better.
I don't know. If it goes the trajectory I'm going to go, which is like, they're going to just start, these things are just going to stop moving when they know it's not real. Because the tip I'm getting at, and I've seen it, I mean, trust me, we scoped up there, looking around. Oh, there's one. See what it does, you know? And what I'm getting at, what my thought process is on this, is the hunt is over. Right? It's no longer a hunt to find them. The only thing that is part of the process now is making the appropriate length cast and presenting the bait in a manner that triggers a strike. And what I'm seeing, and I don't, like I said, I've not rectified all my thoughts on this, but I'm just trying to spit it out, which is, there's a gap. Like, you know how there's always a skill gap between like a guide and a client most of the time, right? You know, if you golf every day versus the guy that golfs once a week, right? Just a different animal. And what I'm seeing now is even the widening, like the gap between guides is huge. And I'm not saying, oh, this guide's better than the other guide, or, you know, this guy's better than this, blah, 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 blah. I'm saying like the knowledge gap is getting immense. And there's a class of anglers that are just running away from everybody because of live scope, because of production, because it's no longer about beating the rocks or beating the weeds until you see one, right? So if you skip the hard part, if you will, the search, the seek and destroy, and we're just in destroy mode.
Yep, and success rate goes up.
Right, and success rate goes up. Because you're presenting to far more fish during the course of the day. You know, and again, I don't have the answers on this. I'm just telling you what I saw and what I'm thinking.
Right. I'm sure you talked to a wide variety of people, you know, outside of, you know, the Herbecks, you know.
Oh, and I'm not talking about, anybody.
You're talking about the guys that come and go that you don't know.
Well,
you chat about muskie fishing. And
practically the
same thing over and over.
Practically the mayor of Dryden. I know everybody, you know. And
do you still have any thought, belief on that signal that the scope's putting out, that hard signal that's turning fish off?
Not yet.
Okay.
I mean, I've seen it, but where they'll stop, they'll come into it and they'll stop. I don't know. Like I said, it's as if it's two different sports.
Hmm.
I think that's where I'm going with this. And where I've said before, what experience do you want to have, right? What experience do you want to have? And it's almost video game-esque when you're watching a fish react to a bait. That's exciting.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
It's here's this digital muskie. You know it's a muskie, and you know that's your bait. You know, and so there's this immersive, a lot of people think, and I've said it before, I'm sick of staring at the screens, but, you know, it's an immersive experience in and of itself. Where you're staring at the screen and interacting, and it's not about, I don't know how to put it. It's not right or it's not wrong. It's just, again, a different experience than the you take that factor of obviously you're getting in front of more fish. Forget mortality. I'm not worried about mortality. That's not where I'm going with this. I'm just going to me where it seems like two entirely different sports.
Yeah. And you're reflecting on a month long in Canada on eagle. And to be honest, eagle is the perfect live scope situation where you, if you had it, if you knew how to use it, it would cut down the time wasted in terms of contacting fish.
Well, it's structurally sets up for it. And then you got certain bays that set up for it. I mean, I fish a lot of water up there too. I'm not just relegated. You know what I'm saying?
No, but I mean, per se, just eagle.
Well, I've spent a bunch of time
entity,
on Dune.
I mean, that's the perfect opportunity for that to be a successful thing. And, you know, there's a lot of lakes in Wisconsin, a lot of weed lakes and stuff. It just can't be that successful.
You'd be surprised.
And the hunt is still a viable thing when fish are in weeds and you've got walls of weeds and shallower environment and all that, you know, the small lake thing.
Yeah, it's different. You know, like I said, it's I'm starting to think again, maybe should have had my thoughts together a little bit more, but I'm putting them together as I speak in a little bit. You know, it's like there's trolling, and then there's trolling for salmon on the Great Lake. Two different animals, right? Just flatline trolling versus like sailing or masts and all this stuff and the complexity of it. And you know, we'll see where it goes. I mean, it's going to, what I can tell you is this: the amount of fish that are on an area or on the thing that'll bog your mind is how many fish are in certain places, right? So if you think there's one, there's probably 20. And how often, once you move them with a bait one time, they're done. Right? So if you engage with that fish on scope, the chances of it eating on a cast back or some kind of re-engagement are so low. And it's funny how many of them, once you move them, they leave.
Uh-huh.
Right? And so it's interesting. I was doing on
that's good. Interesting. Yeah, that's very
where,
interesting.
Where is that's I think some of the overlap here with you know, depending on your methodology, but it's very interesting to see that and the amount of fish that are together. And when I say that they're together, I mean in pairs all year long, right? I had noticed that at home on scope. I talked to Danny about it, and then Danny and I actually witnessed it together twice. And one of the freakiest ones, Jay, it was absolutely freaky, is we're casting, and he's just watching baits, you know, same thing, doing the figure eight routine kind of deal, right? watching baits, and I move one, it breaks off lazy. Where did it go? And we're just watching, we weren't even throwing at it, just watching it, and it goes out towards the main basin, out towards deep water, and guess what's sitting out in deep water waiting on it? Another one. And they pick up and they go off together. Right? Mm. And dialed in as much as I'm dialed in on scope, and no, I was like, I knew it was a substantial fish, right? Can't tell you to the inch, but I can tell you what kind of caliber it was. And it was definitely freaking upper 40s, low 50s, somewhere in that ballgame, right? And it goes and it hooks up with one that was definitely bigger than that. And seeing that, and I saw that on my scopes repeatedly, where, okay, there he is, you hooked up, and there's another one right there, or on the release, there's another one that's lingering around the boat, or there's another one that it goes off into the abyss with. But I think that's one of the weird impacts that I really picked up on scope is, so.
And these are mature fish, right?
These are mature fish.
I've always thought about this. It's like, number one, you kind of only get one crack most of the time.
That's
right. And a bigger fish, it's like, if he comes in and he follows and it's like, oh, he was hot, you know, I should have, okay, I'll go back with, you know, a different presentation, a smaller presentation,
forget about
faster, it. Whatever. It's like, nope, never see him again. Where did he go?
Half the time.
Did he go back to that spot? Well, from what you're saying, what you saw on Eagle, interesting.
Well, and like I said, he keeps saying Eagle, but I also did Loch Sool and Lagoon and everything else. So, but I'm seeing that at home. I'm seeing that everywhere, and it's freaking me out, where it was just one of those things, you know somebody and you trust somebody, and they're having the same experience. You know, I started asking some of my other buddies, like, yeah, we're seeing it too. That you got one shot at them. After that, it's diminishing returns, right? They kind of blow their energy, and then they're done with it. And then the follows get worse and worse and worse and worse. They'll kind of come at it like, meh, right? You got one shot, followed by the fact that they're always running in pairs. And it probably breaks convention. It's one of those things where people, you know, we'll talk about packs of muskies, or they're going to get. I think most of these fish, especially the big mature females, are running with other big mature females or big males all year long. And to your point about moving a big one and going back and catching it, I mean, how many times can anybody like legitimately say, and I'm sure there's one or two stories where the fish has a giant scar or it's got a freaking spoon stuck in its head and you knew it was the same fish and it came back, right? Mm-hmm. I think quite often when we move these bigs, you go, oh my goodness, that was a big one. That was a 4-footer, right? It comes in hot and you don't get it or something like that. You're working that area and you cast back and you quote unquote catch it. I think there's a debate to be said of, did you catch it or did you catch its partner that's schlubbing around with?
Right, because you harassed that first fish and he left.
And it's funny, there's an old Booker story from, God, 90s, where he caught a 50-incher on Lake of the Woods, and he looks down into his amazement, there's another 50-incher sitting outside the net waiting on it, right? And I know he told that on the podcast years back, and that's kind of like, okay, weird and crazy, right? Wow, that's nuts. How strange. Mm-hmm. How weird. What a strange, strange deal. And then you go, now you're seeing it. You're seeing it. You're seeing them run in pairs, the big fish. And you're going, well, that's one, and there's two. Not in threes, but, you know, I've seen some threes, and the threes are usually smalls, about 3 to 5. It's not, you know, there'll be a little wolf pack of little guys and these bigs running together, which is kind of neat. It's one of the core things to kind of observe on that front, and this year it just kind of solidified for me. That, you know, and by running together, are they touching one another? Are they packed up? No, but they're in a couple hundred feet of each other. But speaking, you know, something else, and I'm just sharing some things I picked up here. Something that freaked me out too is the moving these fish and then watching where they go and what they do after you move them, if you don't catch them, right? Because at that point, we're no harm, no foul territory, right? Fish moved, it burnt some calories, but it's not being caught. And watching them go, not meandering, go immediately straight out to where they know that partner fish is. Which is freaky. Right? It's they kind of know where they need to go. It's not like, you know, they're either using structure or they just know that, hey, the my partner I cruise around with is, you know, 400 feet out here in the open water. It's not like they're swimming around looking for this thing. They just go straight to them, Jay. Which is kind of neat. I mean, it's like, okay. Mm-hmm. You know, and again, there's a lot to, there's way. This creates far more questions than it does answers. You know, you go, is it that, is it a breeding pair or is it buddies or is it feeding part? You know, nobody knows. You know, there's not a great answer there, but you go, huh. You know, and we've all.
Or is it an age and experience thing?
Well, and that's, you know, the thing.
Big fish aren't going to hang out with a little whippersnapper.
Right. That's the thing. It's funny where I've rattled around in my brain again, yet to rectify it. Of going, okay, are these the two the same year class, and they've always cruised together, or is it like you said? Hey, there's two big fish that have the same habits. Why not cruise together? What's the benefit of cruising together? Like, they don't get lonely. Maybe they do. I mean, I'm kind of, you know, I'm down here in the cold and the dark, and I'm real sad. It's real sad down here. But, you know, we just don't, nobody really has the answers to the social structure, the social hierarchy of the mighty muskellunge right now. Nobody's figured that one out. But there's something going on. And like I said, it's so often that I'm seeing that. Time and time and time again, when we're after kind of this run, I finally thought, okay, this bear's saying, you know, people I trust are also seeing it, and we've compared notes and thoughts going, huh, kind of strange, you know. So it absolutely blows that crap out the window back in the day where they'd say, well, if you caught a fish off of something, don't go back, you know. Don't go back. Don't need to hit that stump again. They're all gone. So, Lord, a lot to think about. I got, trust me, my ramblings are never ending. But anyway, let's get to some Q&A here. What we say?
Yeah, sure.
Dan Mann here again. Just recently fished Plum Lake for the first time and noticed everyone pounding the same structure, shallow weeds. I tried with no luck and didn't see anyone catch a fish either. Didn't see any panfish or bass, but did catch some hammer handles, moved to deep, steeper breaks, and marked a school of marked a school of skis, and he did see one muskie on side scan over deep water spinning. Okay, blah 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 blah. We're going. The question is, would you have switched earlier? What's going on? So, you know, regardless of what lake it is, if you've got a lake and you're seeing everyone do the same thing and no one's catching, probably time to do something else. And I have always tried to be the guy that's doing something different. I mean, and this is just the thought. If everyone you know is catching 50 inchers, right, do what they're doing. If everybody else is going and fishing for 2 days, throwing bucktails in topwater and getting skunked, that tells me I want to do something different. And that's just always been my thought process because, you know, this thing about musky fishing, and I have my days where I get my butt whipped, but, you know, numbers-wise and quality of fish-wise, I know the program I'm running is delivering, right, which is deep structure, which is saturation casting, and which is really making sure that I'm hitting things from all angles, all this, versus, again, you're watching the people that are going out in there and putting the dog hours, and they're not catching. So when I see a lot of people doing the same thing, unless everybody's catching monsters consistently, I'm going to do something different. Let them have it, right? So in that scenario, when you saw some fish, you saw some skis on downscan, and you're moving out to deeper structure and deeper weeds, I mean, that's a scenario if I'm seeing fish on deeper structure that weeds, that's when you break out the Kraken or a tube, you know, or get some rubber down there and start swinging the bat there. That's what I would be doing. But
yeah, and that lake's a perfect example in exactly what to do. Yeah.
Yeah. Get out on that.
And fish there a bunch.
You know. Yeah, it's just one of those deals. And again, man, if everybody's kicking your butt, do what they're doing. If nobody else is winning, just do something different. Zach, hey, Steve and gang, probably not a podcast question. Well, let's see. I'm planning a couple end-of-the-year trips, and I've got some display issues looking at the moon phase. Wondering if it's now. Okay. Fly pictures. Okay, gotcha. That is a thing about the moon phase. I got a thing I'll fix there. Sorry. Oh, that's a guy asking for. No. What is it? Sorry. Doing her live. Okay. God grief. People with. I am not the Livingston. Guys, the podcast is not the Livingston Lures helpline. I'm sorry. I'm just going to throw that one out there, Jay. The podcast is about the podcast. It is not about freaking the Livingston Lures bath baits or musky shop questions. Sorry. John, we fish a bigger river system in the Ottawa Valley in Ontario, the Madagascar River. Just looking on some good tips on early fall fishing. Lots of pike, no muskies in the boat. Okay, let's look at river fishing in the fall. Guess where we're going to start, Jay? Pocket pools and eddies, right? Just like any other river scenario, regardless of where you're at, you definitely want to look for your pocket pools and eddies. Anywhere that there is flatter, calmer water, right? Not only do these produce ambush points, but they also produce temperature gradients that help these fish out when we're talking about the fall. What you'll see in river fish in the fall, they're staged one of two ways. They are right on top or they're right on bottom. Rarely are they in between, right? Because moving water makes sure that fish end up being the ultimate edge fish, right? So you don't see a lot of muskies sitting in the river just suspended. You know, if it's 20 feet deep, they sit there at 10 and just go, ah, that's not what they're doing, right? They're going to be tight to stuff. So I think the most important thing you can do is find where there's slack water, because it's going to be warmer water in the fall. I would get in the very, very back of it. If you have a big eddy where it's actually, you know, a few casts back, you'll see these like back waters, Jay, and on certain river systems. Well, you'll have, you know, backwater sloughs or any little cuts or anything that slows the water down where it's going to be substantially warmer. I want to go for the very back of those little cuts or little bays. If you don't have that, what you got is what you got, right? And so let's say you just have little small eddy areas or pockets and, you know, pools. What I want to do is spot lock my boat or anchor up to make sure I can hit the crap out of those. Because it's one thing in moving water, people definitely get in a spray and pray methodology where it's not getting covered. You know, because you got to realize if you're fishing from the flow and you're throwing at slack water, if you're just blaring by it, you've missed most of it. But I'm going to look again. I'm going to look in the very, very shallows. I'm going to look off of pulling these fish off the bottom of things in a river system. One thing I can tell you is when you have entering creeks in the fall, this is winter too. So entering creeks, entering water into any kind of river. I don't give a shit if it's a dribble coming in or if it's a whole other river. Always be looking at the river mouths, right? What I've noticed that's odd is quite often you would expect a muskie to be on the downstream side of an entering mouth, right? And a lot of times your most aggressive fish are on the upstream side. So make sure we're hitting both sides. Always check both sides of it. But it's of note that I'll actually pay more attention to the upstream side of entering water on a river system than the downstream side. Again, spot locking, ensuring that I've got really good saturation casting in that area. you know, fall river fish. I mean, it's one of my favorites. I personally prefer to be on moving water in the fall. If you have vegetation, they're going to be in it, period. You know, everything's kind of looking for that last gas of warmth that can get its hands on, especially as it cools down. So get on that and pound around on there, Jay. What else? You fish some river stuff. What else you got, Captain?
Had a podcast listener DM me the other day. He got probably his fattest fish he's ever caught. And he went back on a couple of years ago on the podcast where you were talking about slow rolling top raiders, slow rolling surface baits, slow down. And he saturated gas it, and he was super happy, pumped.
Yeah.
So that paid off for him in that river situation. Very cool.
Yeah.
And that was this week. That was late August.
Yeah. Well, like I said, is it going to be fall or not? We're going to find out. It's just funny, too. I mean, I'm sitting here looking, and, you know, you're losing daylight, too. So we're there.
Mm-hmm. True.
Anyway, Kyle, I cast right-handed. Should I go with a left or right-handed musky reel? So, if you cast with his right hand, Jay, if you're new to the sport and you're starting from scratch, and you don't
have that discussion a couple times this week in the shop with customers that were trying to figure out what was most comfortable for them.
Yeah.
It doesn't matter what hand you cast with, because a lot of right-handers cast with their right hand. They switch the rod over after they've stopped the bait and engaged the reel, and they start reeling with their right. So they cast with their right and they reel with their right. That's traditionally called a right-handed caster.
Right.
So, you know, it's whatever comfortable. I'm comfortable casting with my left with everything and reeling with my right. I'm not switching the rod over.
Right.
None of that.
The rod switch is what costs you fish.
I suppose it could.
Yeah, and what you'll see is these guys that'll cast, and then they shove the rod over in the other hand. Well, the amount of times that you get that fish on the bait lands, or you get it on the drop.
Yeah.
It happens. It doesn't happen every day, but it can happen. I've seen guys miss stuff. Also, too, is you make that cast, and you got to kind of do this reshoveling things around. It's very hard to stay out of the slop. If you're fishing the top of reefs, I hate fishing with people with reefs where they're hand switchers, because I know it's just going to take one slow hand switch and we got a bulldog or a kraken stuck on the top of a reef.
Mm-hmm.
So what I would encourage you to do is use the rod in your dominant hand, right? Because any hand can turn a reel. Right. I can do both left or right, but you know, and I'm kind of backwards on things. I'm pretty competent with both hands, but I'm lefty, but I hold the rod in my right, which I wish I didn't. I wish I actually had it in my dominant hand, because, and I mean, now it's just sheer mechanics and time, but you'll find that if you're really going to fish muskies and you're going to get serious about it, having that in your dominant hand, the rod itself in your dominant hand is far more important, because it's easier for you to articulate retrieves, right? I mean, most people can't even keep time, you know, with their non-dominant hand, right? And so the thing is, you're trying to train, let's say you're a righty and you're trying to hold the reel or the rod in your left hand. How are you going to work glide baits? How are you going to do dive and rise really clean? Are you going to be ripping rubber? Is it going to be sloppy? How good are you with your non-dominant arm? Right? So I would recommend you take advantage of your dominant hand, because you're going, oh, okay, I can really got the rhythm of glide baits really quick. Or, you know, you're going to have better hook sets with that when your non-dominant hands just sit there slopping around turning a handle. That would be my recommendation, is, you know, so if you're a right handy, you know, freaking hold it in the right and reel left, it makes far more sense than the crap that they got us doing. You know, how it's definitely a backwards kind of scenario in my mind. It should have been left's your right and right's your left. But yeah, get that rod in your dominant hand, because I mean, how many people, you know, if you're going to throw a baseball or you're going to do something athletic, You know, that's another, God, that's a whole other animal I need to crawl down at one point. Of just, at a certain point, people have to realize there's some athleticism required for this. You know, and a lot of it, like, reaction time, you know, how fast are your hands? I think is, I told Dr. Bob that in the boat, we were talking about it, just talking all day. And, you know, kind of the thing that came up, he asked me something along the lines, or maybe I volunteered something along the lines of what I thought was actually important. And the most important thing I can tell you right now is if you have fast hands, right, really good reaction speed, you're going to catch way more fish than anybody else. Just if you have a slow reaction time and it's not dialed in, Jay, I know guys that are dialed in and they just aren't athletic. They just don't have fast hands where, you know, you throw a baseball at them, it's going to hit them in the face, right? And that's one thing to consider. And if it's something, you go, man, I miss a lot of fish, you know, because obviously you at the musky shop, me at musky shop and with Livingston, I hear everything, you know, about, oh, well, I like this bait, but I can't hook a fish on it. That shit, right? I love this, but I can't, it's got rubber hooks. Okay. Well, a lot of that problem is just reaction time. And, you know, if you're really trying to be serious about it, that's something to consider paying attention to.
Yeah, I think I just had a bite. Well, you did.
Oh, freaking Danny and I were laughing about the amount of times he'll be throwing a burbot tube, or I'll freaking have, you know, one of those aeolian eels on guiding, and it comes back and it's just ripped in half. I think I had a strike. How the hell did you not feel that?
Yeah.
But a lot of times they don't have to crush you. And a lot of people don't realize that a lot of times that fish will have that bait in its mouth and swim at the boat too.
Yeah, swimming towards you, sure.
You know, well, slick one. It's funny. It's from being on a musky boat far too much and guiding thousands and thousands and thousands of people, from whether they're a musky angler or whether they're just Joe Schmo that's never done it before. What will cost you fish is that reaction speed thing. I'm not the guy to tell you how to build that up, right? But I see more fish get missed and get just missed, not lost, just missed. Like, how did you miss? I don't know how someone misses, right? I don't know how that happens. To me, it's not that fast. Maybe I'm numb to it, but.
I think people, you know, they don't, you know, when they don't have a lot of experience with, you know, retrieving big musky baits and they're always constantly hitting weeds with it, they learn to recognize that feeling. And mm-hmm. when a musky finally hits, they're confused initially. And like you said, there's a little bit of reaction time because it's just like, you know, oh, I thought I just had a weed again, but, you know, I think it was a fish. How many times have you heard that?
Oh, a million. And that's the thing. Hook sets are free.
Yeah.
Hook sets are free. You can use as many of them as you want in the day. They don't charge for those. It's kind of a guide saying I've used for years. I'll just tell people, set the hook. When in doubt, set the damn hook. What's the worst that can happen? We didn't get one? Or it wasn't a fish?
Mm-hmm.
You know? And it's just one of those things. I mean, like, it's something I don't know how to fix that, but it's just an observation that I see of what costs people a ton of fish is that reaction speed. I don't even think, not even, was it a bite? Was it not a bite as much as, like, once guys really get into it and they're really musky fishing with consistency, you know, a lot of that problem is just that physicality, how you overcome that and, you know, probably train your damn self to set the hook. But, you know, when in doubt, load her up. That's going to be the trick there. But anyway, Jay Bird, that is just some more pontification there. Let's wrap her up here, folks. And I will, believe it or not, be back at the bait cave next week. Thank God.
Whew.
And get it. We'll get to sounding pro again. Anyway. All right, Jay Bird. Say goodnight.
Yeah, thanks, everybody. Night.
Later.